With Passport and Parasol, seven true stories of travel and adventure, written and compiled by Julia Kay.
It is the traveller's lot to dine at many tables in the course of many wanderings, but it seldom befalls him to make one of a more miscellaneous gathering than that which overfills the great dining room at Shepherd's Hotel in Cairo during the beginning and height of the regular Egyptian season. Here assemble daily 200 or 300 persons of all ranks, nationalities, and pursuits, half of whom are Anglo-Indians, homeward or outward bound, European residents, or visitors established in Cairo for the winter. The other half, it may be taken for granted, are going up the Nile.
Mere Mortals and Englishwomen, the story of Amelia Edwards, with Anna Massey as Amelia and Peter Marinka as the narrator.
Our appearance in the dining room, tired and considerably sunburnt, may well have had people asking each other where these two wandering English women had come from, why they had not dressed for dinner, and what brought them to Egypt.
The first of the two wandering English women was Miss Amelia Blandford Edwards, and she was not the least embarrassed at being late, unexpected, and unsuitably dressed. Writers, after all, are supposed to be a little eccentric. Her companion was not embarrassed either, but only because she knew no one would pay any attention to her. L. In more than 800 pages of travelogue, Amelia Edwards never even reveals her companion's full name, was happy to dwell in Amelia's shadow. She would travel with her, run and fetch and carry for her, indulge her whims and encourage even her most unlikely projects, as long as Amelia did all the talking.
We have come from Alexandria. We have not dressed for dinner because, having just driven from the station ahead of our luggage, we are but just in time to take our seats. Yes, of course we intend to go up the Nile. In simple truth, we had drifted thither by accident, with no excuse of health or business or any serious subject whatever. Having left home in early September for a few weeks sketching in France, we had been pursued by the wettest of wet weather, debating whether it were better to return to England or push further still in search of sunshine. The talk fell upon Algiers, Malta, Cairo, and Cairo carried it. Never was a distant expedition entered upon with less premeditation. Here, then, without definite plans, outfit, or any kind of Oriental experience, behold us arrived at Cairo on the 29th of November, 1873. We had taken refuge in Egypt as one might turn aside into the Burlington Arcade to get out of the rain.
The Napoleonic invasion of 1798 had, for the first time, opened up Egypt to outsiders. Since then, historians and archaeologists from Europe had been hard at work unearthing and studying the antiquities of the Nile. But it was not until the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, just 4 years before Amelia arrived, that Egypt came within easy reach of the non-specialist traveller. Wintering in Egypt became all the rage. The first Cook's tour up the Nile took place in that same year, and by 1873 the Nile tourist trade was booming. Culture lovers were drawn to the antiquities, sportsmen to the abundant game, and invalids to the salubrious climate.
To the overworked teacher and student, the care-burdened merchant and man of business, the confirmed dyspeptic and hypochondriacal invalid, the depressed and anxious-minded, the nervous and hysterical female, to all these the Egyptian climate may be deemed most beneficial.
Amelia Edwards was neither depressed, nervous, nor hysterical. At 41 years of age, she was a lady of independent mind, independent means, and considerable intelligence. Her father, a military man, had fought with Wellington in the Peninsular War, and her mother came from a family of respected Irish lawyers. While they had been alive, Amelia had been content to remain at home in London, developing her talents as a writer and literary journalist. Since their deaths, when she was 30, however, she had acquired a distinct taste for travel. Together with Elle, she had toured the capital cities of Europe. She had done Florence and Venice, Heidelberg and Oberammergau, absorbing culture like a sponge, and dispensing it in liberal doses to her long-suffering friends on her return. In 1872, the two ladies had spent 3 months rambling through the Italian Dolomites, a journey which had encouraged Amelia to make the transition from novelist to travel writer. Egypt, however, was altogether a new experience. And since it would never do for a travel writer to appear at a loss, Amelia had purchased a copy of that incomparable Vade Mecum, Murray's Handbook for Travelers in Lower and Upper Egypt. The 3-day sea crossing from Brindisi to Alexandria had given her time for a little research.
For those who intend to do the whole Nile voyage and who can choose their own time, the months especially to be recommended, both for climate and ease of travelling, are November to March. Those who propose to do the eastern tour completely should arrive in Egypt in mid-November and remain there till the second week of February, going in a dahabiyah up to the second cataract and back. They should then leave Egypt at the beginning of March and go by way of Petra to Jerusalem. 5 or 6 weeks in Palestine will then bring the traveller to Beirut before the end of May. Of course, these remarks are not intended for those who merely propose to do the country in the shortest time that steam and their own energy can contrive. They may go from London to the Second Cataract in 6 weeks, and any time during these months will be as good as any other.
The last thing Amelia wanted to do was incur Murray's withering scorn by doing the country in the shortest time she could contrive. But it was already the end of November. If she wanted to do the complete eastern tour without falling behind Murray's schedule, she would have to move fast, and that meant finding a dahabiyah.
A dahabiyah is a shallow, flat-bottomed boat adapted for either sailing or rowing. It is unlike anything in the shape of a boat with which we are familiar in England. Indeed, it looks not unlike the Noah's Ark of our childhood, except that the habitable part is all at one end. The miseries of dahabiyah hunting are keener by far than the miseries of house hunting. Dahabiyahs are given to changing their places, which houses do not do. And one gets into an appalling state of confusion when attempting to weigh the advantages of boats with 6 cabins and boats with 8. Boats provided with canteen facilities and boats without. Boats that can pass the cataract and boats that can't. Boats that are only twice as dear as they ought to be and boats with that defect 6 times multiplied. The small boats are too small for comfort or for safety. The medium-sized boats, used in summer for the transport of cargo, are for the most part of doubtful cleanliness. The largest boats, which alone seem unexceptionable, contain 8 or 10 cabins, besides 2 saloons, and are obviously too large for us. All their captains are called Mohammed or Hassan, and none of them speaks anything but Arabic, and all are exorbitantly dear.
The 10 days it took them to complete the negotiations for the hire of the dahabiyah also gave Amelia time to whistle round the sights of Cairo. By the time they were ready to leave, she could look with satisfaction at the 60 pages Murray's devoted to the Egyptian capital and know that she had seen very nearly everything they mentioned, including, of course, the pyramids.
It must be understood that we did not go to see the pyramids. We only went to look at them. The sightseeing of Egypt demands some little reading and organizing if one is to appreciate what one sees. We will come again at our leisure when we have been up the Nile and acquired some practical understanding of the arts and architecture of those far-off days. We arrived back from Giza in the evening to find the difficulties all over and everything settled, though not in the way we had first intended. In place of a small boat, we have secured one of the largest on the river, and instead of going alone, we have decided to throw in our lot with 3 other travellers.
Amelia was justly proud of her reputation as a writer. She had already published 4 novels, books on English and French history, and a volume of poetry, as well as a travelogue of her journey to the Dolomites. But just in case anyone should be tempted to forget her prowess, she referred to herself without exception and in capital letters as the writer. Likewise, she would endow the other members of her party with graphic nicknames. But L would remain forever just L.
Our companions, one of whom is known to the writer and the other 2 of whom are his friends, are on their way out from Europe and are not expected in Cairo for another week. El and the writer, therefore, are to take the dahabiyah to Minye, 150 miles south of Cairo, and there await their arrival. Of all the dahabiyas moored in the shade of the palms, the biggest and the trimmest is our own dear Filey. She is 100 feet long, 27 feet wide, and we are assured has a fine turn of speed. Another boat, the Fostart, lying off a few yards ahead, carries the Tricolor and is chartered by a party of French gentlemen. Both are to sail today.
The invaluable Murrays had shown Amelia exactly how to equip the boat. Her list of stores matched that in the handbook as closely as possible. Given that she was forced to do her shopping at the last minute in Cairo, rather than well in advance in Fortnum and Mason or Savory and Moore. Once on board, there were cabins to put in order, flowers to arrange, books to unpack, the hired piano to be safely stowed, and pictures to be hung on the walls. By the time luncheon was announced, the Filey had been transformed from an impersonal hired vessel into a very cozy home.
Just as we finished our meal, a startling discharge of firearms sent us running on deck. It was the French boat signaling her departure, shaking out her sail and going off triumphantly. I fear that we of the Filey, being mere mortals and English women, could not help feeling just a little spiteful when we found the Tricolor had started first. But then it was consolation to know that the Frenchmen were going only to Assouan. Such is the esprit du Nil. The people in dahabiyas despise Cook's tourists.
Compared with her more intrepid sister travellers, Amelia Edwards was a mere tourist. In her own eyes, an intellectual and an individualist, she would never have dreamt of subjecting herself to the uncomfortable bustle of a Cook's tour. From the comfort of a rattan chair on the upper deck of the Filey, she could look down with genuine pity at those unfortunates who had neither the means nor the imagination for independent travel. Although she had enough of a sense of humour to mock her own snobbery, she was truly thankful not to have to join them.
Happy are the Nile travellers who start thus with a fair breeze on a brilliant afternoon. The good boat cleaves her way swiftly and steadily. Waterside palaces and gardens glide by and are left behind. The domes and minarets of Cairo drop quickly out of sight.
Murray's handbook was far from being Amelia's only reading matter. The Filey's bookshelves groaned under the weight of volumes on the history, architecture, monuments and hieroglyphics of ancient Egypt. By the time they stepped ashore at Beni Suef, 7 days after leaving Cairo, she was confident enough of her subjects to have laid down a plan for the entire journey.
It is the rule of the Nile to hurry up the river as fast as possible, leaving the ruins to be seen on the way back. But the land of Egypt is a great book. Not very easy reading, perhaps, under any circumstances, but at all events, quite difficult enough already without the added puzzlement of being read backwards. I informed the captain, therefore, that we should be visiting some of the oldest sites on the way up. The wind continued to blow all that night, but fell at sunrise, precisely when we were about to start. Coming on deck before breakfast, we found 9 of our poor fellows tracking. That is, they were harnessed to a rope, like barge horses, towing the huge boat against the current. This sight jarred somehow with the placid beauty of the scenery. We got used to it, as one gets used to everything in time. But it looked like slaves' work and shocked our English notions disagreeably.
Amelia was to find her English notions disagreeably shocked on several occasions as they made their way south. The antiquities were wonderful. She was entirely happy to spend days grubbing about in the ruins, picking up shards or sketching in the shade of her white parasol. Present-day Egypt, however, was harder to take.
At Minye, it chanced to be market day, so we saw the town under its best aspect, than which nothing could be more squalid, dreary, and oppressing. The streets were mere trodden lanes of mud dust, and the houses a succession of windowless mud prisons. There must have been 10,000 or 12,000 natives of all ages thronging the streets and marketplace, and it is no exaggeration to say that at least every 20th person, down to little toddling children of 3 and 4 years of age, was blind of an eye. Not being a particularly well-favored race, this defect added the last touch of repulsiveness to faces already sullen, ignorant, and unfriendly. A more unprepossessing population I would never wish to see. Those belonging to even the better class are for the most part shabbily dressed and of more than doubtful cleanliness, while the very poor are simply encrusted with dirt and sores and swarming with vermin.
Poverty and squalor might touch her heart, but they also turned her stomach. Far better to keep them at a distance from where they could look quite picturesque. For the rest of the journey, Amelia did just that. She made no attempt to get to know the people of Egypt. She did not taste their food, visit their homes, or learn their language. And, despite Murray's assurances that she would be quite safe, she never left the boat without at least two members of the crew as bodyguards. The Filey became more than just a home. It was a small, mobile slice of England.
It is Christmas Day. The cooks are up to their eyes in plum pudding. The crew are treated to a sheep in honor of the occasion. And the newcomers have arrived. They consist of four persons, a painter, a happy couple, and a maid. The painter, Andrew McCallum, has already been up the Nile three times and brings a fund of experience to the council, as well as enough frames, canvases, drawing paper, and easels to start a provincial school of art. The happy couple, it is unnecessary to say, are on their wedding tour and have not yet been married a month. The bridegroom is what the world calls an idle man. That is to say, he has scholarship, delicate health, and leisure. The bride, for convenience, shall be called the little lady.
Sometimes sailing, sometimes tracking, sometimes punting, they progressed slowly southwards. The skies were cloudless, the days warm, the evenings exquisite. When there was no wind, the passengers went ashore and walked on ahead of the straining trackers. When on board, the painter painted, and the idle man, who had high hopes of bagging an impressive trophy, kept a keen lookout for crocodiles. The writer wrote and read copiously, Herodotus and Champollion, Bunsen, Marryat and Wilkinson, while Elle and the little lady divided their time between knitting and feeding their animals.
The cocks and hens chatter, the geese cackle, the turkeys gobble in their coops close by, and our sacrificial sheep, leading a solitary life in the felucca, comes baaing in the rear. Such is our Noah's Ark life, pleasant, peaceful, and patriarchal.
True to her plan, Amelia would not permit her fellow passengers more than one day at even the main archaeological sites. The glories of Dendera, Luxor, and Karnak would be explored more fully on the way back. Fortunately, neither the painter nor the happy couple seemed at this stage to resent her busy management of their schedule. Poor Elle, whom Amelia would describe as being culpably indifferent to glory, just carried on with her knitting. The glimpses they did have of these places sent Amelia into ecstasies. Although her understanding of modern Egypt was still and would remain severely limited, she was developing a veritable passion for its past. At Dendera, she lingered for so long over the sculptures that darkness fell and a search party had to be sent out to find her. The great temple at Karnak achieved the greatest coup by rendering her speechless.
To describe it is impossible. The scale is too vast, the effect too tremendous. The sense of one's own dumbness and littleness and incapacity, too complete and crushing. It empties you not only of words, but of ideas. Others might measure and plan and climb, but I could only look and be silent. Many travelers visit the temples merely as a duty. I could breakfast, dine, and sup on temples. My appetite is insatiable.
The traveler who reached Aswan in 1874 was faced with a substantial obstacle that within 30 years would no longer exist. An obstacle that, as far as Amelia was concerned, gave the upper stretches of the Nile an added charm, by placing them out of reach of the common tourist. No Cook steamer and only the cream of the Nile Dahabiyas could pass beyond the notorious Aswan Cataract. After reading what Murray's handbook had to say on the subject of ascending the cataract, Amelia was not convinced the Filey could make it either.
The cataracts that obstruct the course of the Nile are a succession of rapids, whirlpools, and eddies, the ascent and descent of which are incidents in the Nile voyage more exciting than pleasant. Sometimes it may happen that the Nile is so low that a boat which could go up in an ordinary year might run the risk of coming to grief in the shallow waters. Perhaps the best commentary on it is that no one who has gone through it once would willingly do so again, though he might find amusement in watching the process from a nearby rock. For ladies, this is decidedly the most agreeable way.
Construction of the Aswan Dam would start in 1898, and by 1909 travelers would pass the site of the dreaded first cataract through the tranquil locks of a canal. In 1874, however, the fate of Dahabiya passengers lay in the hands of a gentleman called the Sheikh of the Cataract. Only he had the expertise, the men, and the equipment to get them through. Murray's warned that negotiations with the Sheikh sometimes involved delays of several days. But McCallum, who had passed this way before, decided that matters could be expedited by a visit to the governor of Aswan. For once, Amelia was willing to relinquish command of the negotiations.
Our painter, arrayed in a gorgeous kafia and armed with the indispensable visiting cane, sprang ashore to call upon the governor. A couple of hours later, the governor returned the visit. He brought with him the chief magistrate and the judge of Aswan, each attended by his pipe-bearer. We received our guests with due ceremony in the saloon. The great men placed themselves on the side divans, and the painter opened the conversation by offering them champagne, claret, port, sherry, curacao, brandy, whiskey, and Angostura bitters.
This faux pas nearly brought the whole Nile journey to a premature conclusion. Although the governor was worldly enough to be amused, both the magistrate and the judge were profoundly shocked at the mere mention of these unholy liquors. The situation was saved by the appearance of a waiter with bottles of fizzy lemonade, upon which all three gentlemen fell with undisguised appreciation. Amelia was the next to jeopardize their further progress by asking through the interpreter whether it would be possible for them to visit the slave market in Aswan. The smile vanished from the governor's face. The magistrate set down his glass of fizzing lemonade untasted. The judge dropped his pipe.
If a shell had burst in the saloon, their consternation could hardly have been greater. The governor, looking very grave, was the first to speak. "He say there is no slave trade in Egypt, and no slave market in Aswan," translated the dragoman. We endeavoured to explain that in making this enquiry, we desired neither the gratification of an idle curiosity, nor the furtherance of any political views. Our only object was sketching. The governor, the magistrate, and the judge shook their heads, lifted up their voices, and said all together, like a trio of mandarins in a comic opera, "La, la, la, mafiche bazaar, mafiche bazaar. No, 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 no bazaar, no bazaar." An awkward silence followed. We felt we had committed an enormous blunder and were disconcerted accordingly. Whereupon the little lady rose, went to the piano, and played the liveliest thing she could remember, which happened to be a waltz by Verdi.
Verdi seemed to turn the trick. Or maybe it was the third bottle of lemonade. Their mollified guests left an hour later, promising to use their best influence with the Sheikh of the Cataract to minimize any delay. The party then dispersed to entertain themselves till the great moment arrived. The painter, set on a little solitude, disappeared with his easel, while L and the little lady announced they would devote their time to letter writing. That left the writer with a difficult choice. She had herself firmly bracketed with the two gentlemen as the only active participants in the journey. To remain on the boat would be to lay herself open to the charges of passivity she regularly but ever so gently levelled at the other ladies. The alternative, however, was to accompany the idle man on an expedition that she knew would play havoc with her dignity. The decision made, she hid her apprehension under a cloak of disdain.
The writer and the idle man boldly mounted camels and rode out into the desert. This outing figures as the crowning achievement of every cook's tourist. Arabs themselves take good care never to ride on a camel if they can help it, performing their journeys much more expeditiously and pleasantly on donkeys. But for the impressionable traveller, the Aswan camel is de rigueur. It is a most unpleasant experience. You know that the animal hates you from the moment you first walk round him, wondering where and how to begin the ascent of his hump. He swears freely at you while you are taking your seat, snarls if you but move in the saddle, and stares angrily if you try to make him move. Should you persevere, he tries to bite your feet. If you succeed in taking your seat atop this execrable hunchback, you discover that his gait is as abominable as his temper. He has four paces, a short walk, like the rolling of a small boat in a choppy sea, a long walk, which dislocates every bone in your body, a trot, which reduces you to imbecility, and a gallop that is sudden death. The idle man and the writer wreathed their countenances in ghastly smiles and tried to look as if they were liking it. But it was small wonder that the happy couple exchanged an affecting farewell at parting.
Despite the intervention of the governor, it was 2 days before the Sheikh of the Cataract made his appearance. In preparation for the ascent, the windows of the Filey were then shuttered, doors closed, and breakables removed to a place of safety, just as if she were being prepared for a storm at sea.
A general stir among the crew warned us of the approach of the first rapid. Straight ahead, a chain of small islets barred the way, while the current, divided into three or four headlong torrents between them, came rushing down the slope and reunited at the bottom in one tumultuous race. That we should ever get the Filey up that hill of moving water seemed impossible. The steersman held his course. The Sheikh, a flat-faced, fishy-eyed old Nubian, smoked imperturbably. Presently, without removing the pipe from his mouth, he delivered one word, forward. Instantly, the rocks swarmed with natives shouting, gesticulating, laden with coils of rope, leaping into the thick of the rapids, splashing like dogs, and making as much show of energy as if they were going to haul us up Niagara. Ropes from the boat were made fast to rocks on the shore. Long files of men ranged themselves along the ropes, and the Sheikh gave his signal. To a wild, chanting song and a movement like a barbaric Sir Roger de Coverley dance, the hauling began, and the huge boat slowly and steadily ascended. As they warmed to their work, the men chanted louder and pulled harder, till the boat at last swung with a rush into a pool of comparatively smooth water.
This performance would have to be repeated 6 times before they reached the top of the cataract. On the second rapid, one of the tow ropes broke. The 20 men along it toppled over like dominoes on the rocks, and the Filey swung round broadside to the current. Mercifully, the other ropes held. But the incident proved too much for the rest of the pullers. They put down their ropes and went home. The Sheikh, not the least embarrassed by this desertion, promised that they would return in the morning, and Amelia and her companions, slightly bewildered, were left moored midway between two rapids. By noon the following day, not a single man had reappeared. Amelia protested, but the Sheikh just smoked and shook his head. In the cataract, as elsewhere, there were lucky and unlucky days, days when men felt inclined to work, and days when they felt disinclined. Today, as it happened, they felt disinclined.
The painter, being of a practical turn, had compiled himself a little vocabulary of choice Arab maledictions, which he carried in his notebook for reference when needed. We looked upon it as a harmless pleasantry, just as we looked upon his pocket revolver, which was never loaded, or his brand-new fowling piece, which he was never known to fire. But the Sheikh of the Cataract had gone too far. The fatuity of his smile would have exasperated the meekest of men, and our painter was not the meekest of men. So he whipped out his book, ran his finger down the line, and delivered an appropriate quotation. His accent may not have been faultless, but there could be no mistake as to the energy of his style or the vigor of his language. The effect of both was instantaneous. The sheikh sprang to his feet as if he had been shot, vowed the Faili might stay where she was until doomsday for aught that he or his men would do to help her a foot further, bounded into his own rickety little boat and rowed away, leaving us to our fate. We stood, aghast. It was all over with us. We should never see Abu Simbel now. What was to be done? Must the sheikh be defied or propitiated? Should we appeal to the governor? Or should we immolate the painter? The majority were for immolating the painter. But lo, next morning at sunrise appeared the sheikh of the cataract, all smiles, all activity, with no end of ropes and a force of 200 men. We were his dearest friends now. The painter was his brother. There was nothing he would not do for us. The Nubians fell to like giants, tugging away from morn till dewy eve, and never giving over till they brought us round the last corner and up the last rapid. The sun had set. The afterglow had faded. The twilight was closing in, when our dahabiyah slipped at last into level water, and the 200, with a parting shout, dispersed. We never again made light of the painter's repertory of abuse.
The top of the first cataract marked the spot where, a century later, the Aswan High Dam would be built to regulate the sometimes disastrous seasonal fluctuations of the river. Since the 1960s, the remaining 300 miles of Amelia's southward journey have been submerged in the waters of Lake Nasser. The temples at Abu Simbel, Amelia's ultimate goal, would be dismantled and rebuilt on higher ground in 1965 to save them from this fate.
The two temples of Abu Simbel are excavated in adjacent mountains and divided by a cataract of sand. Pent in between the rocks at the top, the sand drift opens out like a fan at the bottom, slanting downwards across the facade of the temple. Forever descending, drifting, accumulating, it labors grain by grain to fill the hollow chambers, bury the great statues, and wrap the whole temple in a golden shroud. When Burckhardt arrived in 1812, the top of the main doorway of the great temple was 30 feet below the surface. Whether the sand will ever reach that height again must depend on the energy with which it is combated.
Amelia and her party had no way of knowing how far the sand would have encroached in the 5 years since it had last been cleared, but the uncertainty added spice to her anticipation. Although the efforts of a mere mortal and Englishwoman could not hope to turn back the giant tide of sand, at least she could record and sketch whatever was left uncovered before Abu Simbel, the elusive wonder, once again disappeared.
The climate became sensibly warmer. The heat of the sun was so great that even with the north wind blowing, we could no longer sit on deck between 12 and 3. Towards sundown, when the wind dropped, it became so sultry that to take a walk on shore came to be regarded as a duty rather than a pleasure. Finally, towards midnight on January the 31st, 1874, the last corner was rounded and the great temple stood before us. Content with what they could see from the river, the rest of the party went soberly to bed. But the painter and the writer had no patience to wait till morning. Almost before the mooring rope could be made fast, they had jumped ashore and begun climbing the bank. I need scarcely say that it was several days before we had even seen half the wall sculptures and chambers at Abu Simbel. Lost in wonder, like rustics at a fair, we felt that we had left the world behind and belonged ourselves to the past.
Emerging from her daze, Amelia could see that the drifting sands were indeed on the move again. Two of the 70-foot-high statues were already buried to the waist, and the floor of the great temple was covered to a depth of 2 feet. Its relentless advance gave an added impetus both to the writer's pen and the painter's brush. Oblivious to the blistering heat, heedless of the clouds of flies that drowned in their watercolors, and the sand that filled their hair, their eyes, and their food, they worked on to record the wonders of Abu Simbel for posterity. By the end of a week, the crew were complaining of being bored, so Amelia set them to restoration work. The face of the northernmost statue of Ramesses was still disfigured by the plaster left on it when a cast had been taken for the British Museum by Mr. Hay 50 years previously. Under her watchful eye, the bemused sailors found themselves scraping off the lumps of plaster and disguising the blotches by dabbing them with bits of sponge soaked in black coffee. No sooner had she found occupation for the crew, however, than her hitherto docile companions rebelled. The happy couple announced they wanted to continue south to the second cataract. Since the dahabeah was their only accommodation, the group could not split up. Reluctantly, Amelia agreed to go on to Wadi Halfa, on condition they spend at least as long again at Abu Simbel on the way back.
We have journeyed well nigh 1,000 miles against the stream, yet for all this, we feel as if we were only at the beginning of the mighty river. How many more miles lie between us and the Great Lakes, and how far beyond the Great Lakes must we seek for the source that is even yet undiscovered?
There is something incongruous in the realization that while Cook's tours were operating at one end of the river, explorers were battling through hostile scrub and mountain at the other end, still trying to confirm its source. The celebrated meeting between David Livingstone and H.M. Stanley had taken place 3 years ago in 1871. Dr. Livingstone had died in the course of his search for that source just 6 months before Amelia arrived in Egypt in search of fine weather. As she stood on the top of the rock of Abusir, gazing south across the deserts of Sudan, word of his death had not yet reached the outside world.
It was the fifth day after our return from Wadi Halfa when an event occurred that roused us to an unwonted pitch of excitement and kept us at high pressure throughout the rest of our time. The painter had gone strolling about among the rocks and did not reappear when we rang the luncheon bell, so we sat down without him. Towards the end of the meal came a penciled note. "Pray, come immediately. I have found the entrance to a tomb. Please send some sandwiches." In less than 10 minutes, we were there. The thing that had caught his eye was a long crack running down the face of the rock at the top of a mound of sand not far from the great temple. He had cleared away some of the sand with his hands, and by the time we arrived, had uncovered a hole about 6 inches long, through which it was just possible to catch a glimpse of the painted wall within.
Careful perusal of Murray's handbook intensified their excitement, for there was no mention in its august pages of a temple, tomb, or any other structure at this spot. Whatever it was that MacCallum had discovered, it was not something that had recently been reclaimed by the shifting sand. It was a structure unknown to modern man that had been buried possibly for as long as 3,000 years.
All that afternoon, heedless of possible sunstroke, unconscious of fatigue, we toiled upon our hands and knees. We had all the crew up working like tigers. By sunset, the top of a doorway was laid bare, and there was enough room for the writer to wriggle in. She found herself looking down into a small square chamber, measuring about 14 by 21 feet, and still more than half filled by a great slope of sand. There was light enough to see every detail distinctly. The painted frieze running round just under the ceiling, the bas-relief sculptures on the walls, gorgeous with unfaded colour. Elle and the little lady took their books and knitting there. The writer copied paintings and inscriptions, and the painter took measurements and surveyed. Meanwhile, the idle man set to work probing a hollow space he had found in the center of one wall. All at once, he thrust his fingers into a skull. The next instant, his hand came into contact with the edge of a clay bowl, which he carefully withdrew. He now proclaimed his discoveries, and all ran to help in the work. Soon a second and smaller skull was turned up, then another bowl, and then the bones of 2 skeletons all detached, perfectly desiccated and apparently complete. The remains were those of a child and a small grown person, probably a woman. The teeth were sound, the bones wonderfully delicate and brittle. The little skull was as pure and fragile in texture as the cup of a water lily. We were convinced now that what we had found was a mortuary chapel, that the hollow in the wall would lead to a sepulchral chamber, and that at the bottom of it we should find, who could tell what? Mummies, perhaps, and sarcophagi, and funerary statuettes, and jewels, and papyri, and wonders without end.
The elaborately decorated chamber, which later experts would decide had once been a library, was all that was left of a monumental gateway tower, which had been destroyed, probably by an earthquake, during the reign of Ramesses II. The hollow in the wall did indeed lead downwards, but only to an empty basement.
Our wonders without end melted into thin air, and we were left with no excuse to carry on the excavations. In vain, we told ourselves, that the discovery of the remains of a large tower, the existence of which had been unsuspected by previous travellers, was of far greater importance than the finding of a tomb. We had set our hearts on the tomb, and I am afraid we cared less than we ought to for the tower. The painter wrote his name and ours and the date on a space of blank wall over the inside of the doorway, and this was the only occasion upon which any of us left our names on an Egyptian monument.
They left Abu Simbel on the 18th of February. From now on, they would be travelling into the wind, so the masts and sails of the Dahabiyah were stowed away. The return journey would be accomplished by the strength of their oarsmen and the pull of the current. The painter and the happy couple were very ready to leave. No one bothered to ask Elle how she felt, and no one needed to ask Amelia.
There are 14 temples between Abu Simbel and Aswan, and we still had many to explore below the cataract. Our happy couple, dead to shame, openly declared themselves bored. I was never bored. Though they had been twice as many, I should not have wished them fewer. I went over them all, took notes of them all, and sketched them every one. Our last weeks on the Nile went by like one long, lazy summer day. And we finally reached Cairo at the end of April.
In 1880, Murray's published a revised edition of their handbook. A small paragraph, tucked away at the bottom of page 543, describes the rock chamber at Abu Simbel, discovered in 1874 by Miss A. B. Edwards, the authoress, and Mr. A. McCallum, the artist. Among the monumental splendors of Abu Simbel, their little chamber may not have counted for very much. But the discovery had had a profound effect on Amelia. She devoted the next 18 years to writing, lecturing, and campaigning for the preservation of Egypt's antiquities. The writer became the internationally renowned archaeological historian. Amelia Edwards died in 1892 at the age of 61, leaving the bulk of her estate to University College London for the establishment of the first English chair of Egyptology.
Mere Mortals and Englishwomen, the story of Amelia Edwards, was written and compiled by Julia Kay. Anna Massey played Amelia, Peter Marinka was the narrator, and Murray's guide was John Baddeley. The producer was John Powell.